Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 23, titled Transforming Anger into Compassion.
You know, people like the Dalai Lama a lot. When they see the Dalai Lama, they feel something special about it. And what is it? My wife taught me that, actually. You know, somebody asked me, a gentleman asked me, who was into gurus, wealthy gentleman, he said, "You've known the Dalai Lama a long time. Did you ever see him do a miracle? Something, you know, produce something out of his ear or whatever, you know." But, and I've seen some odd things happen around the Dalai Lama, but you're not supposed to talk about it in Buddhism. It's against the sort of ethics and the tradition. So I'm sort of hemming and hawing and thinking what to say, you know. My wife is like, no hesitation. "Oh, yes, plenty of times." She goes, I'm like, "What? Okay, dear." So he's like, leans forward in his chair. He says, "What was it?" And she said, "Well, I've seen him very, very busy with a lot of people clamoring for his attention and stressed out and, you know, what you think would be stressed out. And in all of those times, I have never seen him not give his full attention to whoever was right with him and in front of him." And the guy goes, "Oh." So disappointed. But it's so true. Because why? And that's why people feel this way with Dalai Lama. Some people see him and immediately weep. Because somehow they subliminally sense that here is a situation where it isn't our usual thing, you know, which the Tibetans sometimes call this mountain and that mountain, this mountain and that mountain. You know, where you see the other person and you're this person who's an entity inside its skin with a boundary between you, your face, you know, is a boundary between you and the world, and you assuming the other person is like that, and they're also feeling that. So the two of you are like negotiating, you know, and then one hand reaches out and you shake, you know. It's like, "I'm not going to kill you," you know, type of thing. That's what handshake means, right? The weapon in the hand. So that's how we normally are. And suddenly they meet someone who's sort of with them 100%. It's like they just suddenly feel safer. They feel like they don't have to be so frightened and so insecure about their own boundary because they're meeting this unboundaried person. You know, the Tibetans call him the ocean. It's like a giant, vast being. You know? But it's a specific, you can analytically describe it as feeling you are everyone, which is strange, isn't it? But if you've been a little bit in love, you have an idea, at least you've gone a few people, you know? And then this is going way, way, way beyond that. So you get there by what? By not killing. For millions of lives, he didn't kill. He saved lives. He didn't take other people's property, things, away from them. He didn't, and of course, sexuality is the third physical karmic act. Sexuality is where beings do melt their boundary, actually, a little bit, human beings. And they are, you know, become truly close to each other. They kind of can feel their one being briefly. But you know, so to use that abusively, where you're just still hardening your boundary and harming someone and being sadistic or whatever, you know, not caring, then that's a big no-no. It is not necessarily only adultery. It could be any kind of sexual misconduct or abuse. But it's a secular ethic in the sense that it has to do with nature of life, of causal life, and using the causation process in the nature of life to expand your being to become more and more open to other beings and to the nature of reality. And to, because he, based on that discovery, that the broader your awareness of the nature of reality, the happier you are. And the Dalai Lama gives little slogans, like he says, "If you want to be happy, be compassionate," which is not intuitive when you first hear it. When you're compassionate, it means you can't bear the suffering of another person. You know, you really feel their suffering. You want to do something about it. So why would that make you happy? You're expanding your awareness of suffering, you would think. But actually, you're not. Because the reason you're unhappy is because you're so damn sorry for yourself all the time. Because you're dissatisfied. Oh, you never have enough. oh, why am I the only one who didn't hear this? Why am I not in the front row? How come I'm not the head of the Kalapa order? How come, ooh, whatever it is. And then compassion means, oh, that person is much worse than me. Oh, I can do something for them. And forgetting about my own dissatisfaction and my own problem. You know. So that's why the Dalai Lama says when he gets depressed, what is depression? Depression is like nobody ever had this misery like I do. Oh, no, people get mad at God if they believe in God. They get mad at themselves. They'll commit suicide. They just get completely isolated into their own thing. Compassion makes you aware of other people and what's the matter with them, right? So now we come to the issue of the enemy and love your enemies, what they mean. Now, on the surface level, now there are four kinds of enemies in the book that we analyze in, according to Tibetan science, psychology. And the one is the outer enemy. That's the one we normally all think about. You know, the one who hurts you, the one who you're afraid of. If they haven't hurt you personally, you think they might. You know, the terrorist, you know, Hitler, you know, Genghis Khan, you know, whoever. That's the enemy. Or the person at the office who always makes you unhappy or who fires you or what, you know, we all know what the enemy is. Your ex, those are the enemy, the outer enemy. And so that's where you start. Now, why would you want to love that enemy? But what does love mean? In the Buddhist language, as I believe in Jesus' language, love means the wish for the happiness of the beloved. Love is not just possessiveness. You know, I want to do something with somebody. That's not really love. That's greed. That's possessiveness. Love is, I so much like that person, that being, or that thing. I want it to be fantastic. I want that person to be happy. That's what love is defined as. It's the other side of the coin of compassion. I don't want the other one to suffer. And love is, I do want the other one to be happy, the beloved to be happy, right? Now, why has your enemy hurt you and why is the enemy harming you? The enemy harms you because the enemy wants to be happy. Every being wants to be happy. And the enemy thinks you're in the way of their happiness. And they're going to be happy if they can just kill you or hurt you or do something, get you out of their way, you know, do whatever it is that they do to you that's harmful to you. They think that will make them happy. So if they were happy without bothering you, why would they bother you? Do you follow? If they were really happy themselves. Well, you know, they were, it's a guy running around in the desert in Syria with a black flag and a hood over your head and being able to be shot at any minute. You know, that's not fun. That's not fun. They go back to Raqqa and jump in swimming pools and grab some person, but then they grab a trophy wife or something, you know, by violence, and then she doesn't like them, so it doesn't get to be fun. It's not fun. It's like dissatisfying, and it feels bad because the person feels bad around you. And so it's logical to proceed. Now, this doesn't mean people wrongly, we run into all the time, you know, when Sharon and I talk this topic, as I'm sure Buddha and Jesus did, and everybody else was taught in their traditions ever since. Well, if I love everybody, then everybody will beat me up and I'll be a doormat to them. And that doesn't mean that, because it doesn't make other people happy to be evil. Evil people are not happy. They're very frustrated. Therefore, they want you to join them in their misery, usually, actually, people who are nasty. They're unhappy. You can even see the face of an angry, nasty person. They're feeling bad inside. They want to spread that. You, if you want that enemy to be happy, you might very much oppose the negative thing they are doing. So it's just an attitude. You're not hating them means you want to destroy them and want them out of the world, and you want to just obliterate them. Hating is, but loving them means you want them to be happy. So it might mean that you have to oppose them, you have to prevent them, you try not to eliminate them from the world. You realize you can't actually eliminate them. You can only destroy their body, and they'll be back, because everyone gets back. Everyone comes back in the Buddhist world. Everything is interconnected. Everything is infinitely inter-entangled. And so it's the choice of your interaction with the enemy is not just come kill me. love doesn't mean come destroy me. It does not mean that. Jesus, I think, is very misunderstood as he's saying, oh, yeah, okay, I love all the world, so come kill me. Actually, he was not saying that. He was saying, come try to kill me, and I'll show you that you fail. Nobody ever really pays attention to that. I sent a telegram to Mel Gibson. You know, who killed Jesus? Who killed Jesus, you know? Newsflash, Mel, he didn't die. The whole point is he couldn't be killed. He was the kind of being who couldn't be killed. There is such a being, actually. There are such types of being. You know, never say never, because the materialists say no. They are not that logical. They are a little bit cuckoo, materialists. So the people who think they're nothing are slightly psycho. Do you know that? Do you realize that? If you think you're really not there, then you're going to act recklessly and a little bit like psycho. You won't necessarily go into the shower with a knife, but you're a little bit psycho because you think you're something you're not. You're not nothing. You are never going to be nothing, but you think you're nothing. So therefore, you think you can do anything. Any impulse you feel like doing it is okay. Just go ahead and do it if you can get away with it. That's the danger of the nihilistic materialist worldview, non-spiritual worldview. So the outer enemy is more complicated. Buddhists have a theory of self-defense. They have justified self-defense. They even have a theory of war, that you can defend yourself in a war situation, minimizing the violence all the way through. They are against capital punishment from the beginning, absolutely. But they might sanction self-defense. You know, get someone getting killed in a situation of self-defense. They might. So the action with the outer enemy is not just. Be a pushover to the other person at all. In fact, there is such a thing as tough love. You know, that's the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous guy did, tough love. And there's such a thing as fierce compassion. And, you know, those fierce Tibetan deities are supposedly fierce compassion. They're not actually angry at anybody. I don't like to call them wrathful deities that people do. They're not wrathful. They're just showing the form of ferocity to calm down really angry beings, you know. To sort of, you know, get them not to be angry, you know, like that. Then you have the more important enemy is the inner enemy. And the inner enemy is your own anger and your own hatred. And we are, because we are not self-aware enough, because we haven't learned enough about how our mind works, we are vulnerable to when something happens that really bothers us, we feel this rage, and this rage takes us over because it takes a hold of us by a specific handle, actually, which is our wrong habit that our being is some sort of fixed absolute thing. You know, like right now you're looking, some of you are looking at me or looking at something, and you're listening, and in the core of your subjectivity, everyone sort of feels that the same me is always there. You know, that everything is changing in front of me, and I'm thinking also, I'm having inner changes by thinking things, but there's some point in there of something that never changes, because when I see a picture of myself 40 years ago, I was there, and, you know, it's like I was the same person there, I think, although actually everything about me has totally changed. But we have this illusory thing that there's this witness entity that's our real identity, which means sameness in Latin, this real identity that's always unchangingly us. And therefore, it's not affected by circumstances. It's absolute, actually. It's what we call in Buddhism an intrinsic identity or an intrinsic reality or an isolated or independent self. It's not related to the causational process. Do you follow me? Maybe you have a little glimpse of what you're talking about if you think introspectively. Well, then, therefore, when we have an impulse or we have an emotion and a voice says in us, which sounds like it's our voice to us, it says we hear in our mind, that's no good, that guy, that's really unacceptable, you know, I have to get that. This kind of really strong thing comes out. It seems to come from that absolute place. So then we are given over to it and we become mad, we say. Meaning, we become, they have studies that show that our judgment about the circumstances that in which we have this problem, we lose 85% of our reasoning power about how to deal with the situation. It narrows down to like a bull, you know, and a red flag, you know. And we harm ourselves, we harm beings that we love, we destroy things that we value, we become, people will kill themselves, they will kill others, which, you know, which will not accomplish their purpose. They will then be judged, you know, arrested, etc., lose their life. But they will do like that because they become helpless at this, in this energy of rage that seems to come from a place that they cannot resist, because it seems like emotionally absolute to them. Obsession can work in the same way. You know, all of the different negative emotions can work in the same way, but and they have their power over us because they seem to come from this absolute source. Do you follow me? So that's that. Those impulses are the inner enemy, because they are, it's like, you know, you don't like it if it's too hot or too cold. You will turn up the air conditioning or the heater. And so outer things that come at us, we handle it, we try to deal with them, or we suffer them, but if we can't deal with them. But they are not actually as bad as when you have an inner fever, when you have Ebola, when you have malaria, or when you have something that with the terrible chills. When something comes from within, you're more helpless about it because it's inside you. You can't just go turn on this and that heater. So you hope that you can find some medicine or something, but it's more dangerous to you. So in the Buddhist view, that inner hatred, the outer enemy is only motivated by their own helplessness and their own hatred to do something harmful to you. And you have to deal with that. But if they were happy and not in that bad state, you wouldn't mind. You know, they would not do it. So loving them is the right way. Not investing them with the power to really affect you, but then how to do that with yourself. This is there where you learn to control that thing. And here, Sharon Salzberg, my co-author in the book, that she's very good in describing how the seventh element of the Eightfold Path of Buddhist education is something called mindfulness, which has become a kind of craze nowadays in America, you know, by, you know, observing your mind. And how many of you have practiced mindfulness meditation, by the way, here in this audience? Oh, great, a lot of you, very good. Well, anybody who hasn't, it's a great thing for you to try, you know, even just a little bit. You know, what you do is you just sit down. You don't have to even sit. You don't have to sit cross-legged like some weird yogi who's all flexible in the joints. If you're used to a chair, sit in a chair. But you sit down, and then you like just count your breath is a traditional way. You know, you just count, and then you try to just think of 1 to 10. You know, but when you do that, of course, your mind starts going into reveries of memory, remembering something, worrying about something. It starts wandering, and then you sort of just bring it back to the counting. And you do that, and what happens is that you begin to see all that's going on in your mind. And you see how this memory starts to make you feel upset again. Or this memory makes you a little cheery again. And you begin to realize how where the inner sources of your emotional reactions are. And if you do it a little more and you become more adept at it, then you begin to get to where you begin to get a larger landscape in your mind. And you gain more freedom in your mind, where you can actually have a say in whether you react or not to some event. It isn't like you're just a push button reactivity person, if you follow me, because where the reaction comes from, where the distress arises from in the mind. You have a bigger degree of introspection if you begin to do that a little bit, and that gives you a freedom. That's really very important in sort of, you know, developing more freedom from the inner enemy. But it won't eradicate the inner enemy, but it gives you more freedom from the inner enemy. And it makes you know, your mind says, I have to get that person, they did this to me, they said that, that's honest. And then you can then exercise a different voice, a different awareness voice says, well, now why do I have to do that? Or how should I do that? Or why are they doing it? Like, you begin to investigate, and you don't lose your good judgment, and you realize how it is. And then there's other great things. Shantideva teaches in the sixth chapter, it's a wonderful thing where if you can do, you know, why you get mad is because you get frustrated. And you let that frustration build up. And this is very important for women because they're socialized to be polite and not be vigorously aggressive and assertive. So, you know, there's something very annoying them, and then they just swallow it and kind of, oh, okay, yes, dear, whatever. There. And then the frustration builds and builds, and then they blow up and throw a frying pan. And or they don't, and they get sick. And so, you know, so there's a very beautiful thing Shantideva says. He says, that frustration, you should never let it build up. And you should always maintain good cheer and be cheerful and be comfortable in your mind. And what you've got the frustration about is if you see something happening that you don't want to be happening, or you see or something you do want to happen is being blocked by someone. So in those kind of things, then you get frustrated and then you get mad. And your anger comes to you and seduces you by saying, well, you can't stop that or you can't get that done because you're not strong enough, but I'll make you stronger by getting all enraged. It tricks you into that, and then you do something really clumsy and make the situation worse, and then you feel exhausted because you became enraged, and you fail as a martial artist when you lose your temper. And so instead of that, what you do is this other voice will say, well, how will I handle that and deal with that? Then Shantideva says, if you can do something about a bad situation, why get upset about it? Just do it. If you can't do anything about a bad situation, why get upset about it on top of that? Always remain cheerful and never get frustrated. And therefore, what that is teaching is be active before you get mad. And my wife is a great master of that. She's really good. I call it joyful rudeness. Humorous and joyful rudeness. When so-and-so is going on, you know, and telling you about how the Koch brothers are really great and there's no global warming and, yes, they should completely take the Senate and they should, like, screw over all of the good things that have happened since Roosevelt, and you're getting madder and madder, the thing is, when you hear the first sentence, you immediately intervene and say, why don't you stop talking such a bunch of rot? How can you be so stupid, you know, and make a joke? But because you're not mad, you'll be able to think of something skillful to distract them, like, let's talk about the golf scores. That kind of person would be interested in golf. You know, you're like, who's the golf champion now? And, you know, like, just change the subject. But don't right away. Don't sit and listen to two paragraphs and then get really mad. And then have them dismiss you as a crazy liberal. Like, when I come home from somewhere and I'm kind of angry and upset and I've had trouble, I start to tell my wife about it, like, do you know what? And I'm all, like, riled up like that. My expression is like this. And she'll say, why don't you just shut up before we're both upset? And then I go, like, ah, no further. Then, oh, yeah, okay, right. And then it gives me a chance to up-level and drop out, you know. I hope you ladies are listening to that. And that's Shantideva's teaching. Just be active, get in there, and be forceful even, without being angry. And then you'll be much more skillful. It'll be much more effective, helpful to the opponent and helpful to yourself. So anyway, then quickly, I think probably I've been going on too long. And then quickly, then not too quickly, but no rush, actually, I was told. So then there's something we call the secret enemy. And this is deeper, and this is something they're very good at in the Kadampa Center, so you all know something a lot about it. It has to do with the self-habit. And this, in a way, as a psychologist, was the Buddhist tradition and Buddha and his followers' greatest contribution to the world, is their whole insight into the way the mind functions, the wiring around the sense of identity, and how to cultivate a greater resilience of identity, and less rigidity and fixatedness about identity, and learn to overcome prejudices, therefore, racial, gender, national, religious, you know, by developing more openness, you know. And that's the going after what they call the self-habit. And that's the habit of that sort of psychotic thing of thinking, I'm this fixed thing that never changes. And that's real me, and all of this other stuff is a bother, and I have to get away into that real me, which unfortunately many mystical traditions teach as if that's a good thing to do, go and escape from the universe. But the Buddha did not do that. He was against that. He very clearly warned against that. So that's dealing with the secret enemy. And then the super secret enemy is something, I mean, we have it as super secret, but it's a kind of, it's almost the same as the secret one. It's being very preoccupied with yourself and thinking always about yourself and where you are and what you're doing and what can I get out of it, and being very enclosed within a sort of monologue of like I, me, mine sort of thing, which is very similar to the self-habit. It's called self-concern or self-preoccupation or self-cherishing in the Buddhist tradition. And then there's a funny aspect of that that I think is special to us in the West, which we focused on, and that is that at that deep level, when you find about yourself, we all have a remarkable degree of self-abnegation and self-contempt. We are socialized on two sides, from the scientific side, from the religious side. We are socialized a little bit to consider ourselves somewhat unworthy. And part of that has to do with the industrial society that, you know, you have to produce something all the time or you're useless. You know, it has to do with maybe some of the, you know, the authoritarian religious structures that were there in our society, Western society from ancient time, from the male chauvinism. It may have to do with the family system, you know, where the way we're brought up, you know, the busyness and the whatever, depending, even middle class people, parents are so busy and they're preoccupied, they don't pay attention in a certain way to the children. There's all kind of possible special cultural things, but people who have been teaching widely in the world have noticed a special quality of self-loathing in the American population, Western in general, but American one. And that's a super secret thing, because then on top of that, people think, though they think they're, and some psychologists think they're narcissistic. That is to say, they're like, I'm so great, you know. They often cover that up with like, I'm so important and I'm so great. Because inside there's a deep insecurity, actually. It's very strong sense of I'm kind of worthless and I don't deserve anything. And therefore, why should I be happy? You know, what is that? Oh, no, I should be resigned to my misery, you know, type of thing. That's a subliminal thing that is very fettering. And it's palliated by the materialistic worldview that, well, I'm just a body, so as long as I be comfortable, then when I'm dead, there'll be no worry. So I don't really have to worry about my state of mind, because I won't have it. I don't really have it. You realize that if you believe in nothing after death, that means that, you know, if anything gets painful, you just should blow your brains out and you're in the nothing. That means that you are going around as a walking nothing. The matrix there is, you think you're something, but that's a delusion your brain focuses, and the reality is not bliss of nirvana, the reality is nothing. And you escape to that. You can escape to at least, and nothing is anesthetic, by the way. But the problem is nothing, so you're not going to go there. No something can go to nothing, because it isn't a place. You'll never get into nothing. The no something will ever be nothing. My slogan is, please remember it, nobody gets out of here a dead. And the implication of that slogan is, don't be too mean to your exes. Because you fell in love with them many previous lifetimes, you will fall in love with them next life too. And that time maybe they'll have the stronger lawyer. Anyway, okay. So that's the super secret enemy. That's love your enemies. And, you know, one can start by loving your friends, too, and yourself. But the best thing to do to start with here in North Carolina at this time is vote for Kay Hagan. That's the best thing.